We're on. Hey, okay. John McWhorter, how you doing?
Glenn, good morning. How are you?
I'm all right, man. I'm tired. I'm ready for winter to be over, but other than that,
yeah, we have this. I'm 3 inches, and so
etc.
We're stuck with it. But
it's getting kind of boring by now, I think.
Yeah, and as soon as it was melting away, but now here we are in it. But this is the one. It's February, and so I guess we're in Black History Month for one thing. Have you been thinking about it much lately? I must admit, I am having trouble remembering that it's the month of Black History.
Black History Month, and we're Black public intellectual commentators.
But I'm too busy living in the mainstream present myself. But yes, Black History is...
So I was invited to address the state legislature of the state of Rhode Island on the occasion of the Black History Month celebration that they have there in the State House in Providence.
Mm-hmm.
So I paid my dues. You know, I went up, I gave a short talk, we sang We Shall Overcome and other such pieties,
mm-hmm.
And the assembled dignitaries nodded in the appropriate places.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I've had a good Black History Month.
And did you feel that you raised the awareness of Black history among your audience to a point that they had not been aware of it before?
No, I don't think I said anything that they didn't know about. I mean, you know, my speech wasn't anything necessarily memorable. I just tried to say that there's a lot of talk about us living in a post-racial era here in the 21st century with an African-American president and with all the progress that's been made. And I tried to say that, well, certainly things are very, very different than they had been 30, 40, 50 years ago, but that there were, you know, a lot of ongoing problems and issues of African-American status in the society, which made it premature for us to be in a, to declare ourselves to be in a post-racial era.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I said.
You know, I think that this whole issue of post-racial is being used as a kind of a verbal or a rhetorical bludgeon. The notion seems to be that unless we're in this post-racial era, and the subtext there is always that we're not in it, big surprise, and that we probably never will be in it, which is something I'm not sure many people think about, but I think it's perfectly clear. There will never be that. But the point being, we're not in it, but until we're in a post-racial era, there's certain things that we can't give up. And my personal view of it is that post-racialness is something that's never going to happen, and that there are things that can happen even if we aren't post-racial. For me, Black History Month is one of them. I've never made any great fuss about this, but I think that the reason that I think all of us at this point roll our eyes a little bit at the mention of Black History Month, whether you're white, black, in between, or something else, is because it's outlived its usefulness. I perfectly well understand why, in, for example, the 1920s, when Black History Week was founded, that there was an idea that America needed to be made aware of Black history. That would be black people and white people. But here in 2011, I think that in terms of Black history, America is as aware of Black history as it's going to be, with the benchmark being not whether we're post-racial, which I think is just something people use to beat up on each other with. It's just a ploy. Not post-racial. It's the benchmark is how well do mainstream Americans know their history, and how important do we think that is? And I think it's at the point where Black history is part of the same rather utilitarian muddle that comprises most people's knowledge of our history, because most human beings live in the present, not in the past, whether we like it or not. And I think that the idea of having a month for it is something that now strikes me as a little bit 1945, maybe even 1975, but at this point it's a gesture. But the problem is, how do you stop it? Because once you try to eliminate Black History Month, then there's some people who are going to say that's anti-black, when it not necessarily is, but that's what people are going to say. So it seems like maybe we keep on doing it long after we really feel it, which is so much of what life is. But I personally am a little beyond Black History Month. I think that we have Black History Life as much as we're going to, and to limit February to it doesn't make sense. Or the idea being that we have to keep stoking the fires in February or else we're going to forget. I don't see it. It doesn't strike me as empirical anymore. You?
Well, you know, there's a history here. There's a history to Black History Month. There is a reason why this kind of recognition and designation came into existence. I agree with you that as things change, it becomes hard to, you know, deinstitutionalize certain practices, because just to speak the words, let's stop doing Black History Month, becomes kind of a violation of some norm. I also agree, although you didn't say it explicitly, I think you would hold the view that there's something kind of like kitsch. I mean, there's something sort of corny. There's something kind of an anachronistic ritual.
Yep.
You
shake a little ball and you watch the
surviving relatives of Martin Luther King Jr. are paraded across your television screen. Septuagenarian survivors and veterans of the civil rights movement come out and tell their stories once again. We sway back and forth to the Negro national anthem, quote unquote, of "We Shall Overcome."
And lift every voice and sing. Too.
The radical outburst of the Black Panther Party and H. Rapp Brown and Stokely Carmichael and all that are recollected fondly, you know, taken out of their historical context, not evaluated with any kind of critical sensibility, but simply celebrated as, you know. So I think, you know, there's a problem here when you look at the America of the 21st century, which is, you know, fast moving in terms of demographics. Intermarriage is way up between racial groups. Multiracial children or families of, offspring who are straddling the various conventional lines of racial definition are proliferating. We're in a globalizing environment. Everything is moving so fast that these relics of the racial history in the United States seem kind of passé in some way. So, you know, none of this is meant to be disrespectful of the sacrifices of forebears and all
not
that.
Not at all.
But, you know, maybe a part of growing up for African Americans, maybe a part of, you know, coming fully into our own is to be able to maybe not cling quite so tightly to the kind of security blanket of public recognition. You know, this is forcing America to look at Black history and to take us seriously. Well, do we really need to force people? Can't we induce them to take us seriously with the weight of our accomplishment and the significance of what we have to say? Something like that.
Yeah, and I think that it's easy to say. One says, so to speak, that America doesn't pay attention to Black history, and a certain crowd go, oh, yeah, yeah. But is it true? And I think that we tend to forget to look at what the counter-evidence would be. 2001, Glenn, this is 10 years ago, 2001, there was a museum exhibit from the slave ship Henrietta Marie, and it traveled to, I seem to recall, a couple of dozen museums. And there were reports that at almost every one of those museums, that exhibition drew record-breaking crowds. And this is from people of all kinds, not just Black people. That was interesting to me. That same year, there was a little protest among Underground Railroad buffs in Ohio. They were going to set up a sort of a theme park of the Underground Railroad in Ohio, and there was some vociferous complaint about its authenticity and whether or not they were using the right sites and what the implications were going to be.
Yes.
And these were white Underground Railroad buffs. You just read about this thing, this kind of thing, over and over again. And so that's just two examples, and that's 10 years ago. And it just makes you think again and again, here are white people who are very aware of what went on in Black history, both good and bad. And how aware are we expecting them to be? This year we live in New York. I live in New York full time. If you are in the Times Square district, then you see a musical playing called Memphis. Memphis is about the birth of rock and roll amidst an interracial relationship. All the problems that you can expect are depicted in this musical. It's a big hit. Most of the people who see Memphis are not black. And I could tell many Broadway stories like that. And Memphis is a hit. It's going to tour. Ordinary people are going to see it. And so I just think we're at the point where the lesson has been learned. The kitsch is unfortunate, but what really interests me is that I think in terms of making white America aware of black history, we've done it. And so it just seems it's kind of redundant at this point.
There is no black history as such, right? I mean, there's American history in which African Americans figure. I mean, from a certain angle of vision, there is a black history. That is, if African Americans choose to sort of carve out from the flux and the ebb and flow of historical development in the United States, that specifically black, and it's not at all clear where the boundaries are, and one can do that. But you could argue that every day is Black History Month or day, to the extent that people look at American history, since there's no way to understand the development of the country without taking on board the experience of African Americans. And of course, the experience of African Americans is human experience. It's not just black experience, and in that sense, it's relevant broadly across the board to people who are not themselves black. But I want to say something about the distinction between kind of public recognition, which is one reason, you know, remind, quote, white America about the travails and the conquests and victories of black America. But there's also a kind of interpretive dimension, you know, what is the history and how do we tell the story? I mean, because this is contested. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the White Citizens Council, all right, how shall it be remembered, mm-hmm. right? If the governor of Mississippi has, Haley Barbour, a good word to say about the White Citizens Council, mm-hmm. then maybe he's crossed over some line that the advocates of Black History Month and of a certain view of American history are keen to protect. Mm-hmm. No, you can't say anything good about the White Citizens Council. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to say anything good about them here. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remark on the fact that there are surely some Americans out there whose views about the history of civil and political life in the South of the United States in the decades after the Civil War are not uniformly negative. Mm-hmm. They probably have some pride. Mm-hmm. Here we are now 150 years after the beginning of the Civil War, and for the next 4 years there's going to be one after another 150th anniversary of this battle or that event or whatever it might mm-hmm. be, and I foresee unceasing controversy mm-hmm. as people who would fly a Confederate flag or who would have anything fond to say about a brave and effective Confederate Army general or anything like that, yeah. attempt to honor or remember from their perspective, and they will be confronted by people, not only African Americans, with the claim that, don't you remember slavery? Mm-hmm. Don't you know what that war was about? These people were racist. Mm-hmm. How can you honor them? And therein is a, as I say, is a kind of contested historical interpretation problem.
Yeah, I have trouble with that because,
trouble with what?
The idea of dogpiling on any kind of celebration of the Confederacy with the idea that because these people had views about black people and commitments to slavery that we now find repulsive, that nothing positive can be said, there can be no celebration, that really we're just supposed to bury them under condemnation and leave it at that, and that therefore all of these debates about flag showings and battle
reenactment. So let me understand, you're in favor of celebrating the Confederacy?
No, I'm not. But I think that we do have to remember that one has to understand, and this is something that we often saw in particular about 10 years ago with our fracas that arose over, actually, come to think of it, it went on at Yale and I think also at Brown, the idea of buildings being named on university campuses after people who turned out to have connections, direct business connections with slavery. And the fact of the matter is that if you're talking about a long, long time ago, then there comes a point when you have to acknowledge the fact that there was a norm that was only questioned by a very few, and that to make a judgment on an entire person's life, based on their participation in something which they had no reason to seriously question, or if they did, they were a particularly unusual, iconoclastic kind of person. It seems to me to be rather anti-humanist, and it seems that what people are really doing is seeking something to complain about and to condemn, more for recreational purposes than for serious ones. And so, when it comes to the Confederacy, it depends on what the target is. If the idea is that there's going to be a celebration that's being made in complete ignorance of the fact that there's certain temperings or certain acknowledgments that have to be made before this sort of acknowledgment can be made of this person's existence or this battle reenacted or this flag shown, then obviously some words need to be said. But to say that any kind of Confederate flag display or any kind of celebration of a Southern state's history starting in the late 1700s through the 1800s is somehow sacrilegious because of the race question, I think is a little overly simplistic. I think you would agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I'd agree with the fact that this kind of blanket dismissal and this telling people to shut up, you can't possibly think a Confederate general was a heroic figure. How dare you?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's the way to conduct the discourse. I do agree with what you said about the necessity of acknowledging certain things given the benefits of, you know, 150 years of hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, slavery was a horrible blight on this democracy.
I think we agree.
It was criminal. I mean, we can say now with the benefit of 150 years hindsight, mm-hmm. but there were many people who were saying it at the time. This was human chattel. This was an institutionalization of, you know, society-wide violence.
Sure.
Against millions of people, holding them without their liberties, which were supposed to be the thing that the country was founded to foster and to celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
So there was something profoundly wrong that one wouldn't want to sort of slip past quickly, even if one were going to acknowledge that this or that general or Confederate veteran or whatever served what they believed to be an honorable cause with honor and,
mm-hmm.
you know, should be, whatever.
There's a way to do
enshrined.
That. Yeah.
There's a way to do it. But here's what I want to say. The people who don't want to do it, so if I am not mistaken, I believe Michelle Bachmann, the, you know, conservative congresswoman, was making some remark about the Founding Fathers not long ago in which she said that they abhorred slavery or they would work to overturn it or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people on the left responded with shock to the fact that she would remember the Founding Fathers as being anti-slavery since, in fact, the clause that counted African Americans as three-fifths of a person for the purposes of reapportioning the Congress
mm-hmm.
was written into the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this whole argument seems to me to be quite silly at some level because, of course, the three-fifths counting was a compromise limiting the extent of representation that the slaveholding areas would have had in the federal government
mm-hmm.
because they weren't counted as a full person. In other words, the interest of African Americans, broadly construed, might have been better served by
right.
not counting any slaves for the purposes of reapportionment.
In terms of the power
of the
state, the right.
Southern, that just gave the Southern states more seats in the legislature.
Sure.
So you know, grasping at this three-fifth clause seems to me to be silly. On the other hand, Michelle Bachmann's recollection of the founding of the country, not as blighted by the necessary compromise that was made with the slaveholders,
mm-hmm.
but rather celebrating the fact that, you know, the Founding Fathers, these, you know, icons that we now want to trot out, were somehow above the moral mess
mm-hmm.
that's, you know, weren't tainted by
mm-hmm.
it, didn't have any, you know, negativity associated with it. That's a misremembering of history, and someone ought to
And you know
that.
Something, Glenn, it's interesting
so.
You say that because I'm not sure whether we differ here or not, but I'll bet I do with a lot of people. Many people would think about Bachmann and that certainly ignorant view of how abolitionist in general the Founding Fathers were as evidence
yeah.
that, yes, America is not where it needs to be. We need a Black History Month so that the Michelle Bachmanns will understand how a Thomas Jefferson or a George Washington or a James Madison or a James Monroe felt about Black people. I disagree. I think that the fact that when Bachmann says that, there's a critical mass of informed people, and it's not just some fringe, a critical mass of people who will immediately rise up and say, that is absurd. That is evidence that we've gotten somewhere, because imagine how that would have been in, say, 1940. It would have been six college professors. We're at the point where a Michelle Bachmann stands out in her ignorance, and that'll do. We're not gonna eradicate ignorance. We can't have an America where there won't be a Michelle Bachmann who's under the wrong impression about how people felt 200 years ago plus about black people. The issue is how close we are to something reasonable. And I see something reasonable in the fact that a you, or the very many white yous who objected to what Bachmann said, are around. Many have influence, many don't. But that means that we're aware, because let's face it, how much does Michelle Bachmann know about white history in, you know, even 25 years ago? People are not historians. And so...
you and I agree about this, but it seems to me there's another aspect to it, too, which is that some of this is not even about history at all. It's just using historical talk as a way of signaling, conveying a stance about contemporary issues. Okay? So, for example, I imagine that some of the celebration of Confederate historical figures by conservative persons in the southern region of the United States that's ongoing today, some of it has to do with, you know, a kind of regional historical memory and a kind of identity. You know, we are, you know, siding with the South and the war between the states, which is, you know, something you can do 150 years after the fact, mm-hmm. as a kind of, you know, as I say, a kind of cultural expression. But some of it is anti-black. I mean, some of it is, we don't like the fact that there's a Negro in the White House, mm-hmm. or some of it is, we're sick and tired of seeing Jesse Jackson or Bernice King, mm-hmm. or whoever it is on the television being touted as some kind of figure and, you know, all this, because we don't feel it. Or some of it is, we've had it with affirmative action, we think these people are criminals or whatever it is. And you can't say that explicitly, so you end up with people endorsing what seem like outrageous. I mean, in other words, what I'm saying is the injury and the disrespect, mm-hmm. that many African Americans feel, mm-hmm. is intended. Mm-hmm. This is a way of getting in your face. This is a way of saying to heck with you, to African American liberty. Because we've got this kind of political correctness, you know, which dictates the proper way. Right? You know, if Trent Lott says that Strom Thurmond was a good guy when we voted for him in Mississippi, mm-hmm. In 1948 when Thurmond was running as a Dixiecrat and Trent Lott remembers that fondly, mm-hmm. then you can drive Trent Lott from his seat as Senate Majority Leader with a publicity campaign that says, oh my God, how could he have ever said such a thing? Mm-hmm. He's pro-segregation, mm-hmm. you know. But the people who voted Trent Lott into the Senate didn't stop thinking what they were thinking because you drove him from his leadership position. They reacted to that, probably, in my mind, I think, with, you know, a conviction that those darn politically correct liberal Negroes will show them, and they just displaced their aggression someplace else by raising a Confederate flag someplace or something like that.
No, I don't see it. Never have. No, this reminds me of how I felt with Trent Lott, although I agreed that he needed to go because of the position that he was in. But there's a difference between overt hostility, between having a problem with affirmative action and the color of Barack Obama's skin, and just not seeing race issues as a priority. And for many people, that's an equal sin. That's a whole different conversation. But
you're saying it's more the latter than the former, that just don't see it as a
priority? I don't see the evidence that it's hostility as opposed to people who just don't care. And we can talk about whether the not caring is a slippery slope towards the hostility. I think people exaggerate there. Different conversation. But the idea that we have a regional pride and that that might have something to do with a states' rights orientation towards how things should be run. States' rights doesn't have to mean being hostile against black people. It can, but it can also mean that you're against a quote-unquote Marxist or socialist way of running the country, and a sense that our generals, even if they were fighting for something that specifically wouldn't agree with, some of them were kick-ass battlers, etc. You can have that sort of sentiment, and maybe connected to other sorts of negative things. It doesn't have to be about being angry at black people. It can be about, yeah, there's a black issue, but we're white, and we don't care about this race stuff. What many of those people would say is that black people have gotten all that they're going to get and all that they need. They need to stop complaining. But that's not what they're upset about. For them, it's just that that doesn't matter. So, for example, Trent Lott. What he said about Strom Thurmond was based on this probably boozy, but even if it wasn't that, kind of fellow traveler feeling with a southerner who was 700 years old, and Lott is thinking about Strom Thurmond as a piece of history who had lasted a very long time. And for Trent Lott, big surprise, race issues were always kind of a nuisance, and as far as he's concerned, we're past it, I don't care, he's white, he's not a social reformer. And so something fell out of his mouth based on that rather unreflective sense of things. He doesn't care about black people. He doesn't care. That doesn't mean that he was in favor of the segregationist policies that Strom Thurmond was advocating and that he would have liked for America to be a segregationist place in the year 2002. I just don't see that it's necessary to think that's what he meant. It meant he didn't care. And the notion of being so offended about somebody not caring is one that I've just never been able to quite feel. How perfect can people be? No?
No, I don't think I agree with that, John. I mean, I'm thinking about Holocaust denial as you're talking. Okay. I mean, these are not the same things at all. They're not at all. They're not at all the same thing. I'm not saying they're the same thing. I don't think they're on the same level at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. On the other hand, I think to say, oh, look, I'm not anti-Semitic, but, you know, the historical fact of what actually happened is open to investigation, and I just want to, you know, I'm not drinking the Kool-Aid. I mean, they said 6 million. I mean, how do you know it was 6 million? Maybe it was 3 million, you know, whatever, whatever, you
mm-hmm.
know. And a person could say that and could wrap themselves in a, you know, I'm just for raising questions and looking at the evidence. I'm not anti anything.
Mm-hmm.
But the meaning of the inquiry,
mm-hmm.
right, I'm talking about in the case of Holocaust denial, the meaning of saying, let's open the books and take a look. I'm not just going to buy what people are telling me about what happened in Europe
during
the war.
Right.
That there's something, you know, deeply disquieting and in a way injurious to not only Jews but people who would humanists. In you know the spirit of that just doesn't seem quite right. Now you could say the people who do it are not motivated by blatant and overt anti-Semitism, and that well may be true.
Uh-huh.
But you would be foolish if you were on the lookout for the interest of Jews, in the example at hand, to ignore that kind of rhetoric. And likewise, that kind of rhetoric, likewise, to have a major American politician speak about the campaign of 1948, where an openly segregationist Dixiecrat left the Democratic Party and ran for president, and to speak fondly about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's something at stake.
I don't see
Americans and for black Americans encountering that.
No, I don't see the analogy, because the person who is doing this active investigation into whether or not it was 6 million Jews, et cetera, has a distinct and concrete commitment to the whole issue of Jewish history, which someone who stands next to Strom Thurmond's wheelchair and says, well, it's a shame he didn't get further, old Strom, it's different, because Trent Lott has no commitment to black issues. For him, it was just a tempest in a teapot. He didn't care. He probably has unsavory feelings about the equality of black people. But it wasn't that if we're going to be disturbed, it's not that what Trent Lott was saying was, boy, don't we wish it were back to the time when black women were maids and black men swept. What we've got now is unfortunate. Wouldn't it be nice if we would go back to segregation?
I'll bet you, John, that if there had been 10 or 15% African Americans in the audience to which Trent Lott was speaking that day, he never would have said what
he said. Oh, of course not.
When he said we, the antecedent of that first person plural was not all of Mississippi. Okay? And I think he had to know when he said we that he wasn't speaking for the 30% or whatever it is of the state's population, which is African-American.
Sure.
So I got to hold him responsible as a public official, even if there's a boozy and folksy, you know, my brother from South Carolina, we're fellow Southerners and whatnot. I mean, he's representing all of the people of the state of Mississippi, and in the Senate, all the people of the United States of America.
Oh,
and,
sure. You know, it was a...
Just can't let that one
it
go.
It was a gaffe, and I didn't let it go. I remember disappointing people back then by saying that somebody who is this disregarding of the black thing should not be in that kind of power in... Okay, but wait, Glenn, this is important. What was going on with Trent Lott was it was more of this basic human issue, and it's just like George Washington and whether or not people of his type should have their names on buildings. Trent Lott, as a good old boy Southerner, does not see his views about black people or those of his comrades as the sum total of what he and his life and his parents and his friends and his wife and his trajectory have been. We look at him and we immediately think, oh, how did he feel about black people? And maybe that's fine. But in his own head and in the head of the people who he has spent his life with, that's one thing, but it's not everything. And that man's old enough that even there, wouldn't you expect someone like that to sometimes slip up like that and forget to be acknowledging of something about his past and present that's of more importance to people other than him than it is to him, but which he has a responsibility to acknowledge? He slipped, but it wasn't. And this is where we disagree. It wasn't bigotry. It was disregard. It just wasn't a priority for him.
Well, that's not nothing, man. Disregard is not nothing, especially about an issue like this. But I don't know why I'm arguing with you, because basically I agree that the reaction against him was over the top. And basically I agree that politically correct thought police around the racial issues are a relic, and in a way are dealing from a position of weakness. I mean, they're exercising the last ounce of power that they have, which is the power to police what people say in public, when they can have very little influence over what people say in private, and they have very little impact on the substantive policy agenda, which is about what we do collectively through our government. So they're reduced to policing the discourse, shouting down the putative racist, and standing on there, don't you know what black people had to endure in this country all those years, mm-hmm. kind of thing, to which everyone will politely and quietly accede, the point. They'll see the mm-hmm. point. Politely and quietly, but then they'll go away thinking and doing just what they were doing before.
Hey, Glenn, here's one.
Yeah, so I basically agree with you, so I don't know why we're arguing.
Well, then
let's talk about something else.
Let me give you another one.
Okay.
Arlene Johnson is a black undergraduate at Murray State University in Kentucky. This is one that's going to get around this week. I'm giving it to you here first if you haven't already read it.
I'm hearing it first from John McGuire.
And she goes to a film class led by a Professor Wattier, Mark Wattier. Mark Wattier is white and middle-aged. I'm not sure how old, but I'm 45, and I've just been told I'm middle-aged. He's certainly my age. So
stop, John, stop. Because I'm middle-aged, okay? So I don't know what you are. I'm middle-aged.
I was told that
at 62. Somebody,
so that,
I'm not elderly.
Somebody was doing some math at a party. But this middle-aged
okay.
guy, and so she's late to film class, late as in the film is already 15 minutes in. And she says, well, how come the film's already going? And the professor says, well, this is the class policy. We always start the film 15 minutes early. And I imagine that might be because movies run 2 hours and there isn't enough class time or something. But the thing is, he had not announced this policy. And when Arlene Johnson said, well, how come this wasn't announced? His response was, well, I wouldn't expect you to be here on time anyway, because slaves were always late and they got lashed for it by their masters. This
Ouch.
Happened
he
recently.
Said that.
He said it. And he was suspended without benefits. And as of, I believe, last week or the week before, he resigned. And this is, I want to ask you this one, because I think, I'm a renegade on this one. I think what he did was horrific. I mean, there's just no pardoning it. I'm not going to talk about disregard. I mean, that's just vile. I say he's an outlier. I don't think that he is a justification.
Well, he singles this young woman out, and based on her race, and then he makes an injurious statement to her. That was very rude to say.
It was horrible. And I don't,
it was very
I don't think
rude. Suppose she had been a handicapped person, and he cracked a joke about wheelchairs.
Yeah.
Okay, et cetera. You can see where we would go with this. And that's not the way a teacher who has power
never
has a real impact on people should use that
no.
power.
No, but there's more.
Decent educational institution is going to, you know, want to police that kind of thing in terms of how you conduct your classroom. That's perfectly
they
legitimate.
Should. But this is the other part. And so he, all of what you said is true. I would never condone that. But now Arlene Johnson is asking for a personal apology from him. She wants an apology. I think that she should not want him to apologize because the apology probably wouldn't be sincere. And if she puts herself in the position of wanting the apology, she is lowering herself to him by acknowledging that he was in a position to hurt her with his benighted ignorance. I think that she should see the publicity of the event as the just desserts. If she wants to hurt him, well, he's hurting. But she should not expect him. She should not want him to say, I'm sorry. Her strength is in walking away from it, having announced what he did. Do you think that she deserves an apology? Because the analogy there would be this sort of public outcry in the media where the idea is that people need to atone. Should people atone for this sort of thing? I don't think so.
Well, you say, does she deserve an
apology? No, not deserve. Should she ask for
it? Which is different than should she ask for
one,
okay? I do think she deserves an apology because she was injured wrongly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that one would, if one wants to acknowledge that the injury took place and that it was wrong, that one would acknowledge through apology. Should she place herself in the position of being a, you know, of seeking an apology,
mm-hmm.
of demanding, of publicly, of, you know, going out and after it? I could see a person saying, no, the dignity argument that you just made doesn't sound necessarily wrong to me. But that feels to me like it's kind of a personal call, whether or not she would want to place herself in that position. I don't know that I can say it would be wrong to do so, but I do think she deserves an apology given the facts as you've outlined them. Yeah.
That it would be valuable to tell a person in her position that you shouldn't allow what was said to hurt you? This is how I felt about Michael Richards yelling the N-word at the black patrons of the comedy club. One of those patrons was on TV saying he hurt me, and I thought to myself, he shouldn't have. Because if you know you're not a nigger, then nothing somebody's yelling in some comedy club can make you feel like one, depending on what we're calling.
No. I think this is wrong, John. It's not just that something has been said and I'm offended by the word. It's a public display, okay? And so the public display of that kind of ridicule or that kind of diminution, mm-hmm. which is implied by calling someone a kike, a spick, a wop, a
mm-hmm.
nigger, okay? The public act is it's a power move. It places people in the position where they're susceptible to being derogated, you know, having derogatory things said about them in this way. And you could say for any given individual, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. It's just water off of a duck's back. I've learned long ago not to pay any attention to that kind of thing. And that well may be a sensible strategy for an individual
and the
person.
Only one that I know of.
You know, navigating the show. A woman who finds herself constantly confronted in the workplace with sexual innuendo and things like, let me just finish. So I'm saying a person might say, the woman or whoever it might be, look, I got a job to do here. I'm not going to get all bent out of shape about this. Okay? So at an individual level, fine. But from the point of view of the society as a whole, I think it's a very healthy and good thing that people object to and insist of that it cease behavior of this kind, because to not do it is to basically allow for a power dynamic to evolve in which, it sort of gives license to abuse people in a particular way.
I think that she would be remiss, this Arlene Johnson, if she didn't publicize it. I don't think that she should think of herself as a duck with water rolling off of her back and just not say anything. My personal issue is with that apology. When I was in college, I was at a comedy club once. The year is 1984. This is in New Brunswick when I was at Rutgers. And I was off in a dark corner, and I think pretty much everybody else in the room was white. And it was an open mic night, and you were supposed to get up and tell jokes. And a white girl got up, and she opened right up with, what do you call 100,000 black people at the bottom of the ocean? A good start. It's kind of an old joke anyway. And, you know, there was a nervous laughter in the room, and I think that was a sign of the times. I think today the room would in most places would be silent, even if it were full of white people. But this was 30 years ago. Nervous laughter. And I remember thinking, what an ignorant, pathetic woman. And I would never have gone to the people running the club or to her and said, I demand an apology for your soiling of my dignity. As far as I was concerned, I was above her. And remember, at this point, I am 18 years old. I have not accomplished a thing. There was nothing I could call special that I had done. It wasn't that I was 45 years old and, you know, a professor or whatever. I just felt for her to get up and tell that joke is something that makes her kind of a troglodyte. I didn't want an apology from her. I felt just fine, and I enjoyed the rest of the night. And I'm wondering, does that make me some kind of freak that I wouldn't have wanted to be soiled by the apology from her? That's how I think Arlene Johnson.
What I see here is a difference between the public broad collective interest and the individual's idiosyncratic decision about how to handle an affront. Hmm. And I think it well may be that a person carries himself through the world with dignity mm-hmm. by not reacting viscerally to such affronts, not letting them take up that much space inside their own heads, not wasting their time cajoling and arguing with people about, am I a human being? Of course I'm a human being. I don't need to convince mm-hmm. you of that. I see that very clearly at the individual level. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is, if behavior of this sort is not sanctioned, if it's not publicized and if it's not objected to, then something happens publicly, something happens broadly and collectively, which is bad, which is a kind of sliding of the norm about the boundaries of civil conduct, sliding in a way that's injurious to African Americans as a whole. So it's like paying taxes, you know. The individual might have to suck it up, and go ahead and do something that they don't want to do, which is to say, object to the conduct, even though at a personal level they may feel that that's not how they want to spend their time. They do that in order to maintain a broader public climate, mm-hmm. Which is not injurious to the group as a whole. This is, anyway, my analysis.
I get that. And I just want to say very briefly, I am not against protest, public protest of these sorts of behaviors and policies. It's the interpersonal part where I sometimes get confused. I think some people think that I'm the old-fashioned bourgeois Negro who thinks that we need to go real slow and not make too much noise. No, I understand what protest is for and how you break walls down. But it's just what you do on the individual level, where I sometimes think, what happened to that aspect of dignity and sticks and stones? One does not lower oneself. But you do make a public display. I get that. But, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm curious, John, about your connection with Glenn Beck, because I've heard that that you actually have picked up on one of his attacks on socialist and communist intellectuals out there. You know, Beck is constantly lecturing his audience, and I gather that Francis Fox Piven is in his sights, the intellectual now must be quite far
social out of work years, professor Columbia, right?
Is she at Columbia?
Was at Columbia, right?
Was, okay. And wrote about welfare policy back in the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. and was fairly radical in her views. And Beck has made a point of attacking her, and you have made a point of attacking mm-hmm. her. And I'm just wondering if that can be a coincidence, or if you're not secretly, a closet admirer.
Yep.
Of the Fox News.
Yeah, story. Contrarian me.
Now, how far can you take contrarianism, John?
Yeah, I think Glenn Beck is a genius. No. It would be great to have that excerpted. No.
Exactly. Everybody heard him. He said it.
I have had a problem with Francis Fox Piven's espousal of people. This is 1966. She espoused.
A long time ago,
but I think it was historically significant. And, we've been through this on Blogging Heads a million times. She was somebody who was very pivotal with her husband, Richard Clower, in advocating that poor black people seek welfare when they had been working. And her idea was, and this is not, I'm not caricaturing, this is what she wrote with her husband. The idea was to break the bank of the government so that there would be a social revolution in how money was distributed in this country. Now, that is not something that bothers me in itself. It's not something I necessarily would have chosen, but that's, she's a leftist, okay. But I don't like the fact that it created an amount of multi-generational welfare dependency that I don't think was healthy for the black community. And we've seen... seen this, and today she still doesn't think there was anything wrong with what she espoused. That's always been my problem with her, but I first wrote about that back in the year 2000, and I've written about it several times since then. Glenn Beck went after her about starting January before last, and frankly, because I don't follow Glenn Beck, I didn't know he had said anything about her. I wrote something about her the last time in March of 2010, and apparently there are some people online who think that I was watching Glenn Beck and then wrote about Frances Fox.
So the arrow of causality goes in the other direction.
Thank God, that's
what you say. But now, first of all, 45 years ago, somebody wrote something. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're still talking about it. Okay.
Yeah.
Secondly, really, an intellectual caused so many black people to be on welfare and not their own poverty and economic penury? I mean, really?
Yes.
Thirdly. Yes, he says. Thirdly, Richard Milhouse Nixon was trying to enact the Family Assistance Plan in 1969, 70, 71, which would have guaranteed a paycheck coming from the federal government to every poor family in the country.
Yeah.
And he's not on your hit list.
Nope.
A leftist social work intellectual is on your hit list. But the idea that people would get money from the government when they were poor was not something that was confined to the fringes of the left. So I'm not sure. It doesn't add up to me.
It's very simple. Welfare, as far as I'm concerned, is an important thing in a fundamentally wealthy society like ours. And if the idea is to save somebody from working as a menial for the rest of their life, and for them to be on the rolls for some years while they get job training in order to be able to do something that will allow them to have a better life, then I think welfare is great. Current welfare, for example, I think is a wonderful policy, but there has to be a cap and there has to be job training. But Frances Fox Piven and her husband, and Richard Ellman as well, were responsible. They were very effective. They sparked a nationwide movement with the National Welfare Rights Organization to urge people to go on the rolls who hadn't gone on them before and weren't going to. And the problem was that they ended up staying on the rolls, too many of these people, forever. It created the kind of neighborhood, and you and I have argued about this, but it created
You keep restating it. I don't want anybody to think I agree with what you're saying. I don't think it created these neighborhoods. I think it was quite the other way around. The arrow of causality went from poverty to welfare, not from welfare to poverty, is what I would
and
say.
And we always
you to demonstrate.
And we always get stuck on why then. You know, how come that arrow happened starting in 1966? Wouldn't that have happened?
Okay, so we could argue that, but we won't. But I want you to address my Richard Milhouse Nixon point. I mean, it wasn't just the wild-eyed left. I agree with you, the National Welfare Rights Organization was especially mm-hmm. muscular mm-hmm. in its assertion of prerogative on behalf of poor people. But as I'm saying, the tenor of the times was such that even a Republican president, being advised by Daniel Patrick mm-hmm. Moynihan, could make as a principal part of his domestic policy agenda the guaranteeing of federal assistance to every poor family, which would have universalized welfare, destigmatized it to a certain extent, but would have still continued providing assistance
and
to poor people.
So that blood pressure goes up.
It wasn't just the
my
left.
My blood pressure goes up even thinking about that because the family assistance plan that you're talking about that Nixon espoused or was made to realize it would be wise to espouse, that makes perfect sense to me. I understand that. And what derailed it was that because of the mood that Piven and Cloward and Ellman had a lot to do with setting up, it wouldn't go through because people who were on the left and the people they could influence demanded that there be more guaranteed income
Indeed.
Than was politically feasible to institute. And so the FAP just went down the toilet when that could have created a kind of change in this nation that I would have liked. Ask me if I want to go back to...
Oh, you would have liked the family
sure.
assistance plan.
I mean, I don't want to go back to a time when 9 out of 10 black women couldn't expect any better than to be maids for the rest of their lives. That was no good. But what went on in 1966 with Piven and her assistants ended up creating a vision that ended up hurting an awful lot of people for generations to come. And that is my only problem with her. Now, Beck has got this problem with her Marxism and her socialism, etc. That's not my point. She has a right to her views, and I'm not into creating witch hunts against people online. I had nothing to do with any of the people attacking her for that. I happened to say something else about her after Glenn Beck had started jumping in. I had no knowledge of anything that those people were saying.
Okay.
So I just wanted to make that clear.
The John McWhorter-Glenn Beck connection is fiction. Everybody needs to take note of that. McWhorter was there with the wrong idea first. And Beck followed in train.
I like that. Just as long as...
So what are we going to say about Wisconsin? Because everybody's talking
Glenn,
about
Glenn, we can't do Wisconsin because I have to go to school. And so...
Okay, we have to do Governor Scott Walker and the union-busting thing on another
let's
occasion.
Let's do that one next. Because, yeah, I've got to upload and then I've got to get in the car. And so...
All right, John. Good talking to you as
you
always.
You too, Glenn. And we'll...
Are we going to do lunch
this
week?
Yes, let's do Thursday.
Okay. Absolutely. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, we'll start it again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.